our second presentation here is being given by, well, Walter Bradley, the co-author who just entered the room, and Robert Marks.
Who's standing on the side. Thank you.
So, and there's a, yes, if you could connect that to yourself somehow.
No staples.
Okay. So this is your microphone, which
This just dangles here?
Yeah, or in the pocket as well.
Or in the pocket, okay, too much in the pocket.
All right.
Thank you so much. This is my first time to speak at an ASA conference, and it is great to be here amongst other believers who celebrate the Lordship of Christ, and it's just delightful to be here. I've learned a lot. I'm still learning, and I'm going to make some presentations here, and maybe, hopefully, if you comprehend some of the things I can say, you can help me to make this better. I do want to recognize Walter Bradley, who was originally slated for this talk, and if it goes bad, I'll blame you, okay? So, also, I want to acknowledge the Evil Informatics Lab, and neoswarm.com. These are both my websites, and they contain a lot of the literature that we're going to look at here. I want to go through a number of things. The first one is, what is information? We have information which is spread out all over the place. You know, this has information, and the word is used very, very loosely. And we all know about the failure of Shannon and Kolmogorov information to capture the sort of information that we rely on. So let me spend a little bit of time on defining what is information. Is information energy? Well, certainly information can reside on energy, if you think about radio waves, so you can put information on energy. Information exists on matter. DVDs have a bunch of little optical pits, right? And there you have information which is placed on matter. However, we have to ask ourselves if indeed this is information, does this mean that if I was to take a DVD and I ran it through a shredder, would I be destroying information? How many think I'd be destroying information if I ran a DVD through a shredder? Can you see just by the smattering of hands, there's really no there's a disagreement on that fundamental idea of what information is. So if I shred a DVD, am I destroying information? Well, it kind of depends if there's a backup copy, right? In which case, maybe I'm not destroying information. What if I make a digital copy? Do I create information? If I take a DVD and I make a copy, am I creating information? Or even more fundamentally, if somebody in the back takes a picture of me on your million by million pixel camera, are you creating information by doing that? So what is information? I think these questions kind of reveal the idea of information being all over the place. Norbert Wiener, what a name. He's the founder of cybernetics. And he said, information is information, neither matter nor energy. And in fact, we have a lot of study of biology, a lot of study of physics. But really, information is part of our universe. It's everywhere. And there's been no deep study of exactly what that information is and how it plays upon this world that we live in. In the beginning, I don't know if you ever thought about it, God hovered over the waters, and in the beginning, what did God do? He made information, didn't he? He took everything and took it out of order and put it in order, in some sense, in information. Shannon information fails to do or to capture the sort of information that we want to talk about. Claude Shannon admitted this. He said he created information for the purpose that he was using, which was with communication systems. I will be proposing here a different method, which is called algorithmic specified complexity, so stay tuned for this, which is a technique wherein meaning can be measured in bits. Not just the algorithmic, not just the Shannon information, not just the Kolmogorov information, but the actual meaning of an object can be measured in bits. And it's something we observe, we know it when we see it, can we measure it? So the second thing I want to talk about before I get into that model is information in simulated natural selection. My background in electrical engineering and computer engineering includes simulated evolution. There's an entire IEEE is my professional organization, largest professional society in the world, 470,000 members worldwide. That's pretty big. But one of the societies is computational intelligence, and we have a journal called Evolutionary Programming. Comes out quarterly, and it's about engineering applications of evolution in the design of different objects. And so I come from this background, and so let's see what damage I can do here. I will tell you that in computer evolution, that is the evolution that we compute, that we use on the computer, that the mutation and the selection mean nothing. That is, you mutate and you select, that means very, very little. It means something. It allows you to get to the final result. What means everything is the fitness that you assign to the so-called emergence that you're attempting to do. You have to have the right emergence. I used to work with a guy at Boeing named Mike Healy who did optimization. He called himself a penalty function artist, which means that he would sit down, he would craft this fitness, this penalty function that he was looking for. So let me show you some, we were tasked by the Navy of doing a couple of things. Let me show you, the first one is called centering here, and I'm going to show you a video in a minute, but it turns out that swarming is defined as a number of independent agents, and they only know what they are doing, and they're just aware of their immediate environment, so there's no overall supervision. And swarming has a long history in the military. One of the things that swarming does, one of the first ones, was Alexander the Great lost his first battle because of swarming. There were mounted Sith warriors that came and attacked his troop. And it wasn't actually Alexander, it was one of his generals. But it totally decimated him, and it was Alexander's first loss because of so-called swarm intelligence. What we were tasked by the Navy to do was evolve, was to perform evolution on swarms to see if we could come up with some interesting emergent behaviors. And let me show you some of the, one of those at least. By the way, Alexander came up, his general came up with an idea that what he wanted to do against the swarm, and this is how they won the battles, is they moved their army against the mounted archers, moved them next to the sea where they were trapped, and they killed them. So it turns out that in swarm environments, it turns out that all of the kills are on the boundaries. So one of the interesting things that happened in this simple evolution, as you can see, the red is the predator, the green is the prey, the mounted archers, if you will, is that the archers learned how to avoid the walls. They basically all reverted to the center. That was the way that they learned to survive. Now, what was the fitness here? The fitness here was how long the archers could survive. Here's another very interesting one. And you wouldn't have expected this, but later on, because putting in some different emergent behaviors, we got actually the agents, the dweebs, the prey, if you will, to actually demonstrate self-sacrifice. So what would happen is that one of the agents would come out, all of the predators would run around and chase that one agent while the others were safe, and that one agent would sacrifice himself for the good of the entire herd. And this was an emergent behavior. And as you can see, this will go on and on. I think this one finally gets eaten. The predator comes back for the prey runs away, but you can see that it gets duped again into running around and for this self-sacrificial result. So these are some results, and we didn't expect these when we ran the evolutionary program, which is very interesting. However, I get back to the PowerPoint slide. Is this it? Yeah, that's it. And I'm going to ask, do these simple evolved swarms display, display information? Are they emergent? My answer is no, that they weren't. I had laid out in these programs numerous scenarios, and the computer, through an evolutionary sort of search, looked through these scenarios and found these. The ones they found, I wasn't expecting, but in retrospect, looking back, you could see, yeah, this happened, oh, that was really good. So I would maintain that there is exactly zero information which was generated by doing this. Part of it was the fitness, which was allowing the swarms to survive as long as they could. Gregory Chaitin is probably one of the greatest mathematicians of the latter part of the 20th century. He, along with Kolmogorov and Solomonov, created Kolmogorov-Chaitin-Solomonov information theory. Some people know this as Kolmogorov information theory. And he came up with a very interesting statement. He said, "The honor of mathematics requires us to come up with a mathematical theory of evolution and either prove that Darwin is wrong or right." He wrote a book about this, and we actually showed very nicely in his book where he was putting information in order to make his evolution work. We actually shared the paper with him. He's a professor in Argentina right now, and he liked it. He said, "Man, this is, thank you for the thoughtful understanding. I can see what you're saying. Would you send me a copy?" We sent him a preprint so I can share it with my class later. But anyway, I like this guy's idea. It would be nice if there was a certain type of mathematical model. The idea of a model, even a mathematical model, especially in computers, goes back to the 1960s. People were saying we have had this sort of evolution for a long time, and people were excited in the 60s by the advent of the computer with the idea that it would be possible to now simulate on a computer evolution, which would never happen in real time. And here was one of the people that it did it. Here is the result of that. After, in 2014 or whatever, probably the most famous artificial life and evolutionary was Tierra. Tierra was supposed to, it was written by a guy named Thomas Ray, it was supposed to explain the Cambrian explosion. He tinkered with it, he messed around with it, and finally abandoned it as hopeless. It was his computer model to perform the Cambrian explosion. Aveda was very famous in the Dover trial, if you're familiar with that. The co-authors of Aveda, one of them, Pennock, came and said, "Yeah, I have simulated information." But just like what I showed you with the swarm, the analysis of Aveda showed that the authors had placed the information into the program in order to make it work. In other words, Aveda had an intelligent designer. There was actually no question about it. There was another one, EV, and then Gregory Chaitin's Metabiology. That's the book that he wrote. It's called Proving Darwin, if you want to buy it on Kindle. But all of these have failed because either with Tierra, it was just a failure. He didn't do anything close to what he wanted to do with the Cambrian explosion. The other ones didn't because they were teleological. They had a goal in mind, and all of the information that they needed in order to make them successful was placed in the program. So it's been a failure. These are results in computer science that debunk the idea that one can do this. The so-called no free lunch theorems, late, I think it's 1997, Walpert and McCready, idea of conservation of information, active information, and Basinger ceiling, which I won't get into, but the basic idea of Basinger ceiling is once you have any dynamic process, it has a certain limit that it can go to and it can't go any further. Now, this actually brings us into kind of a different area. Many of you have heard about, I think it was a month ago, the purporting that the Turing test was passed. Anybody read about that? It was a guy named Gustman, I believe. And the Turing test was something generated by Alan Turing. By the way, interesting on Alan Turing, he lost his love in high school. And he turned from God, he became an atheist, and he decided to dedicate the rest of his life to proving that man was a machine, and as a result, founded computer science. That's the motivation behind what Turing did. The guy was a genius, he's recognized as the father of computer science, and it just goes to show, no matter what your ideology is, if you pursue the truth, you're going to get it. But Turing test is totally not a test of artificial intelligence. I'm going to fold this back into the evolution just in a minute. Here is a modern take on the Turing test, which is so true. It says, "Though progress towards Turing's dream is being made, it's coming only on the strength of clever but shallow trickery. For example, the human creators of artificial agents that compete in present-day versions of the Turing test know all too well that they have merely tried to fool those people who interact with their agents into believing that these agents actually have minds." If you're familiar with Serling's room, his argument against that a computer will ever understand what it does, this plays very well to this. This was Birksjord. He's a great guy in this area. He actually suggested the Lovelace test for so-called strong AI. Strong AI means that a computer will be generated, if it passes the Lovelace test, a computer will be generated that computes something that wasn't expected by its program. That's the Lovelace test. And that's the new hurdle that artificial intelligence has to pass over. Ada Lovelace, by the way, was one of the, some say the first computer programmer, worked on Babbage's work, Babbage's computing machine. So we have all of this. Now, here's a conclusion that I come from, and I need your help on that. I know I'm asking you to assume everything I told you is true, but just assume it for a minute. If there are insufficient probabilistic resources in the multiverse, something possible can be impossible. This is actually Borel's theorem or Borel's law. It's something which goes back for many, many years, and I could do a lot of quote mining here. But I can stand here, and it's possible that my left foot will tunnel through the floor, right? Quantum tunnel through the floor. There's a finite probability that that will happen, but it will never happen. The probability is just too small. There is a probability in the universe that you could go out and in the entire universe choose five atoms. I could go out and choose five atoms, know nothing about the five atoms that you chose, and that those atoms would be the same. That's possible. No, it's impossible. It will never work. There are certain probabilities beyond which things simply become impossible. And computers can't simulate unguided natural selection. I think that's beyond a doubt right now that the creator of the computer must infuse information into the program in order to make it work. And remember, this is important, computers, Turing machines, can compute any algorithm. That's their purpose, they compute algorithms. So if you're given an algorithm, you can implement it on a Turing machine properly. So here's my conclusions. Even the evolution requires probabilistic resources beyond the multiverse. And I use the word multiverse here on purpose. This is my understanding of string theory saying we can have over 10 to the 1,000th parallel universes. And even if we did that, we would not have the probabilistic resources in order to allow these things to work. Or evolution is a meta-Turing process. It can't be explained by a Turing machine. It can't be explained by a computer. Now, this might at first sound kind of crazy, except that we're seeing meta-Turing machines occurring all over the place. Roger Penrose, who, along with Stephen Hawking, published the first paper describing, I think, the formation of black holes, is in agreement with this, wrote two books dedicated to showing that the mind was beyond a computer. And there is recent development in epigenetics, this is less developed, wherein some of the epigenetic activity in the cell is being purported to be non-Turing. So things are happening there which can't be performed by a computer, by a Turing machine. Or there is an intelligent designer guiding all of this, putting the information in the universe, or I'm missing something. So this is where I come from the area of computer science. Now I want to talk about, very quickly in my few minutes left, about the meaning of meaning. Remember in the beginning we said we didn't have a way to measure information? I'm going to propose to you a way that we can actually measure the meaning in information and how it works very well. The actual impetus on this is that we're all familiar that if you have a DVD, you can have Braveheart on it, or you can have a bunch of noise, right? But it both takes up the same number of bits, Shannon bits. Same thing with Kolmogorov, Chaitin, Solomonov theory. By the way, this Chaitin is the same guy that we talked about previously, that wrote the book on evolution. He founded evolutionary information theory when he was a teenager in the Bronx, New York. Just a prodigy. Published his first paper at the age of 17 and did it coincidentally with Kolmogorov and Solomonov. Five? Oh, I thought I had... Okay. Okay. So Kolmogorov, Chaitin, Solomonov information is simply the length in bits of the smallest possible lossless compression. we're all familiar with compressing files. There exists a maximal compression that you can have on a file, and that, ever how big that is your Kolmogorov or KCS information. Now, there's conditional KCS information, and here is the kind of weird thing about this metric that I'm imposing, is that meaning is in the eye of the beholder. If I ask you to look at this, does anybody read this or even know what it is? Well, it's not only Arabic, but it's upside down in a mirror image of it. But the point is, somebody like me that doesn't know Arabic, that doesn't have any meaning. I don't have the context to give that meaning, do I? And most of you don't either. This is a great example. Anybody seen this picture before? You will look at this and you'll say, that's just Walter Hess. Yeah. You'll just look at this and you'll say, it's just a bunch of blobs. But I tell you something, once you see it and once I show you what it is, it will be in your mind forever. And what your mind is doing is looking around for context to place this in so that your description of this will not be big red blob, it will be cow. It's a picture of a cow. And the cow is over here. He's looking over his shoulder at you. Here's the two eyes, the ears, and the nose. So right there is the face of the cow. How many see it now? Okay. Now, the interesting thing, you didn't see that the first time, but you only saw it and identified it because you were able to place that cow in context. And we know that this has more meaning than this. But guess what? This has more meaning for me than it does for you. You know why? Because this is my family. You can probably recognize me here. But this, you will look at and you'll say, oh, those are people. Okay, so you have certain context. I have, yeah, but this is Brother Ray, my wife Monica, my daughter, her husband, etc. So this has more information. It has more information for me than for you. So the conditional Kolmogorov complexity is simply the Kolmogorov complexity given context. These are like little subroutines that are attached to the file from your experience and what you have in order to establish context. Here's algorithmic specified complexity. It's the natural difficulty of the problem minus the conditional Kolmogorov complexity. I won't belabor the math because I know it's not a lot of fun. Let me give you one that's kind of very recognizable. In playing poker, we all play poker as Christians, right? In playing poker, a royal flush has meaning. It has meaning, right? Why does it have meaning? It has meaning because out of the 25 million or 2.5 million possibilities, there's only four that are royal flush. Let's look at the Kolmogorov complexity. To specify a royal flush, what do you have to do? You condense the file into identifying the suit. One out of four. That's it. That's all the information you have to know. So all of a sudden, this big royal flush is condensed down into only two bits. And from this, we can actually go forward and calculate the algorithmic specified complexity of the different card hands. The royal flush turns out to be 16. That's about the same amount of information of getting a heads flipping it 16 times. So you see that the concept works. It turns out algorithmic specified complexity is rare. If you have an algorithmic specified complexity of 10, it has to be less than or equal to 2 to the minus 10. So it's a bound, which is very, very small. Another thing it does, improbable things happen all the time, right? You get a snowflake, that snowflake is very improbable. But it turns out the algorithmic specified complexity of two different snowflakes is zero. Nothing exciting here. But if you have two identical snowflakes, all of a sudden the meaning goes up, it shoots up to, in this, you know, under our assumptions, 3322 bits. Now, I was going to show you the game of life, but I don't have time to do that. The game of life is so cool because it's a cellular automaton that is just basically does four rules, and hobbyists have designed things such as this. Right down here, obeying four rules is actually a Turing machine which is generated. And on the top, these are actually a manufacturer of gliders. And these manufacture these little gliders that are spit out here. And we can actually look at the degree to which these things have meaning. So I'm not going to have time for that. But we just had a paper, we just sent in the galleys for a very nice journal paper. So in Finnish, here are the takeaways. When we talk about information, we need to agree on its meaning. because I think we get into arguments a lot of time about, oh, this is what we're about. Let's define our terminology. When we talk about natural selection or evolution, let's define our terminology. Algorithmic specified complexity measures meaning in bits. Information and evolution comes from fitness, and computers' information is supplied by an intelligent designer. That's the way it is here. Time-varying landscapes require even higher levels of design to agree to achieve ASC. I don't have time to go into this, so I won't. And if there is not an intelligent designer, could the development of life be non-algorithmic? In other words, could it be like the mind that no algorithm can explain what is happening? So that's the state of our research now. And that's it. Thank you for your.
Are we have time for some questions?
Yes. Can we define information as a difference that makes a difference? For example, you said a radio wave. You were saying a radio wave unmodulated has no information.
Yes.
The modulation gives it.
Well, I think that philosophically you could. I like the idea of algorithmic specified complexity because, as Chaitin said, in order to get our hands around this, there probably has to be a model. We have models in the soft science of financial engineering, very sophisticated mathematical models that win Nobel Prizes. I think that natural selection warrants that sort of that algorithmic description myself. But it seems to me that a lot of these anecdotal things where things are happening really do not fall into the rubric of a large theory that we would like to be able to do. Now, Thomas Ray through Tierra tried to do it, but it was a failure. And I'm not saying that we can't do it. I'm saying it's a lot bigger task, if it can be done, than we ever thought.
So perhaps one last question from Jamin.
Great lecture, by the way. And I really appreciate how you define what information is. A few years ago, I published an article called A Christian Theory of Information, and I went through three definitions, and one of them was basically that information is synonymous with meaning. That seems to be where you're going.
Yes.
And that's for obvious reasons, because, you know, information existed in DNA before we understood anything about it. But then the question is, is that a fair way to summarize it? Do you think that information really is synonymous with meaning? And then,
well, it is. I think that we had the DNA strand, and again, I'm not. This isn't a field that I'm an expert in, but we knew that there was information there, but it only had meaning after we began to investigate and find out what each of the little strands corresponded to. That it was incomplete. That it led to epigenetics.